Welcome back to Community Connections, and being the first Monday, I don't know why I always say Monday, Peter always picks on me for that, but being the first Wednesday of the month, we've got our private investigator Peter with us. Now, I'm just having a little bit of a problem here with the connection, but we'll just see how we go. We'll just talk to Peter. You there, Peter?
I'm here, Alan. Can you hear me?
Yeah, beauty. We've got you. We've just had a few little hassles today on the computer, on the iPad, but we're right here now. Now, Peter, first of all, how are you, mate?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Yourself?
Oh, very well, thanks. Peter, we had to cut you short last month, which I was very disappointed about, but we had a police forum coming up that we just wanted to promote. So we were in, there were a few things that you were going to talk to us about that, was left over from last week, including, I think, the one from the month before, whatever it was we sent you away with.
I did have a little bit of homework. Thank you very much for that. And one of the first ones was to do with about body cameras and about whether notification was required in respect to wearing body cameras. So to start that little section off, I had a quote here from Victoria Police, which basically says they may not always tell you when they are turning on their body camera. And then, of course, the comments were made that if someone's wearing a body camera, generally they are in plain sight. And a red light may well indicate that the device is operational. So I guess if you're looking closely enough, you probably sense whether a body camera may be switched on or not. It's not actually illegal for a civilian to purchase and wear a body-worn camera, but there are laws and restrictions for engaging the device and recording other individuals with it, noting that they generally have both video and audio functions. Now,
can I just ask you there, Peter, because we're not talking out of school here, but I believe that Woolies and maybe Coles or a couple of those, because of the incidents of abuse against their staff, they're putting in, they're supplying it to some of their staff. So does that imply the same as what the police would, that, you know, that they don't have to tell you that they're using them? Oh, I suppose, in all honesty, you do see them, don't you?
Yeah, look, you've preempted about my second next paragraph down the page there, Alan, so well done you. So I'll continue on with where I was, if I could.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. So the question was, is there specific legislation about notice being required?
Yep.
The short answer is no, or at least I can't find any. So I think it's like many, many things in the developing technology world, that legislation is way, way behind the actual use and availability of things. So again, nothing specific about having to give notice. The warnings, though, that come out of using of body camera, of course, go all way back to privacy, the expectation of privacy, and the specific laws governing video and audio under the Privacy Act, noting that the audio part of it, the audio component, is far more protected and potentially unlawful than the video component.
Which
I've pointed that out a couple of times before, that the Privacy Act is very much video in a public place is generally okay, and I'll use the word generally carefully, but audio, you have to be very, very careful about with audio. So you do need to ask permission. You can audio things, and I think some of this is coming up with a prominent Liberal Victorian Party court case at the moment about meetings being recorded. My understanding is where you have to be very, very careful is when a third party hears the audio. That's where the actual offence takes place. So
if you and I recorded, if I was talking to you, say, privately, and I recorded it, that's probably not the problem. But if I then took it off and to Joe Blow down the street and said, "Hey, have a listen to what Peter said," then that's where I get in. Oh, right. There you go.
So it's but it's a very grey area. To my understanding, I'm not aware of that actually ever being tested yet. I might be proven wrong, but that is where my understanding is. It's when another party hears the conversation that you then potentially have major, basically federal privacy law issues. So just one to be careful of. And of course, that leads us in, Alan, to preempted me on, is that the Australian Retailers Association suggest one in every four shoplifting incidents involve abuse or assault against workers, which of course has prompted Coles. It's Coles, as I understand it, probably Woolies will be doing the same. An ongoing trial where 30 Coles stores across Australia, with staff being fitted with cameras to only be turned on in inverted commas, threatening situations. And workers have been instructed to warn customers before switching on the devices, which I think answers the question that you were leading up to.
Well, that answers the question too about what you were just saying about the audio being used to someone else, doesn't it? That
it can in a way, but Alan, just I'll reread this just so to make it. Workers have been instructed to warn customers. Now, I read that differently as to workers are impelled to warn customers.
Oh, so what you're getting at? Yeah.
Yes. So Coles, as a matter of courtesy or deference, have instructed their workers to tell the customers that they're about to be body cammed or recorded, as opposed to it actually being a legislative requirement at this point in time.
Yeah, I didn't pick that up as you were saying that. That's a good point, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's always subtleties with these things, and like probably anything else in life, and until it goes pear-shaped, you could probably get away with bits and pieces. But if you get caught out and something's gone wrong, then obviously authorities will come down on you, like a ton of bricks, basically.
Peter, as a private investigator, and we don't want to know your tactics, we're not going to touch... And I should mention that you're from Absolute Facts, because you give us your time, so we should mention that. Have you ever used a body cam, or would you use it? And if so, if you took it, used it, would that then be able to be used in a court case?
Look, it can be. To answer your question, I've never personally actually worn a body cam. I have had in the past what we'd call bag cam, a bag camera. And obviously in the previous eras, we've used video cameras in various ways, shapes or forms, including being hidden in bags or somehow hidden or somehow sort of discreetly put away. But to be honest with you, Alan, in today's technical world, your mobile phone's pretty much the universal tool, as you probably well know from seeing people walking around. So and it's less I guess in many ways it's sort of less suspicious because everyone's playing with their phone all day every day and bumping into things. So yeah, that, to be honest with you, my primary tool out in the field would be my mobile phone.
Peter, I've just got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more. Listen, call up, and cry, like a baby, and cry all Was Queen with Crazy Little Thing Called Love, and we're talking to Peter from Absolute Facts. Peter, we did have an inquiry, and in fact two or three, about if you were starting up a business, what sort of equipment would you, if you were doing it yourself, I mean you know more about this stuff than any of us, what sort of equipment would you put in to try and protect yourself for asset protection?
So I'm going to assume we're talking about a small retail shop here initially, and then we'll go on to the larger,
yep,
larger shop or factory later. But look, if I was to open a small shop, I think one of the first things I'd be looking at, Alan, would be a basic CCTV system. I think that's a good starting point. And it could be as simple as having just one decent CCTV camera, the best one you can afford, so to speak. And obviously that has to be appropriately situated to obtain the best, say, head and overall images. And also, of course, the importance of the footage retention. So would suggest at least 7 days of footage would be about the minimum. And, of course, then not only that, it also has to be easily accessed you yourself need to know how to work the system so that you can obtain and burn footage. And, of course, the follow-through from that is that the footage, when it is obtained, has to be in a format that's basically easily transferable so that you can pass it on to presumably police or someone like that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you give them in format that nobody else can see or read or open, then it sort of defeats the purpose in some ways.
Yep.
So that would be probably for a small shop, that would be my investment in respect to asset protection, if you like.
Yep.
And then obviously, and given my background, of course, I've got a fair bit of cynicism behind me, but look, general awareness and vigilance, Alan, would make sense. Perhaps a little bit of staff training if you've got part-timers or casuals that are manning your shop or perhaps manning your register, more importantly. Recommend things like regular stock takes to identify your shrinkage so that you know what you're losing, how much you're losing, and probably then concentrating on what particular items you're losing the most. And then you probably consider repositioning those items, either the ones that are most targeted or probably the ones that are most valuable to you. You place them presumably closer to your counter or in a position that you can keep an eye on and things like that. So, look, common sense comes into it to a fair degree as well, Alan. So, you know, things like don't place toiletries near the toilet if you happen to have a toilet. And, of course, one of the other basic things you can put up is if you've got blind spots in your store, in your displays or shelvings, wherever your setup is, throw a mirror up in the top corner there so that you can be at your register. You can be at your register and basically look at the mirror to prevent blind spots. And obviously, people of ill intent are likely to be deterred by a well-placed mirror.
Well,
so that would be
if you're a large business, Peter. Like we're talking.
Well, with a larger business, it's kind of almost the same thing, except again, I would probably go with the best possible CCTV system that you can afford, because at the end of the day, police are relying more and more on this to assist with prosecutions, and it could almost got to the point now, Alan, that it could be argued that these days, without clear and damning footage, prosecutions may not even proceed at all.
Fair dinkum.
No, because, I mean, you know, it's too easy to say. Well, in the old days, with some of that grainy footage, you could say, no, that wasn't me, and things like that. But I think these days, particularly with the larger retail stores and their systems, it's pretty you're reasonably identifiable, as we as we've touched on before. So I think if you had a larger retail, you had more at risk, and that could same could apply for perhaps a factory and manufacturing or something. Obviously, you've got to be careful where you put your cameras. You can't put cameras in bathrooms and toilets. I'm not sure, but I don't think you can put cameras in like changing rooms and even changing booths within a retail scenario. So you would probably put a well-placed camera that might show how many items of clothing are being taken into a changing room, as compared with how many items come out or get left on the hook, or in fact get put on underneath other clothing. So so again, it's probably investing as much as you can afford within reason on good CCTV footage, and obviously you'd have expert advice as to where you put your cameras, and how you record and retain the footage. Again, probably at least for 7 days, or probably even going out to 14 if you're a larger setup. And again, how can you access and what we term as burn the footage so that it can be passed on to authorities?
Peter, you mentioned during that staff training, if I was setting up the business and you came in and you said, look, I'm going to give you staff training, would the training be to tell the people to get involved, or would it be to tell them just to take details and don't get involved?
Yeah, look, that's an excellent question. And look, at the end of the day, these days, I think the overwhelming advice is to not get involved, because you just don't know who you're dealing with. You know, and we're hearing about particular youths walking around with knives and machetes and things like that. So I think even the basic sort of armed hold-up or hold-up type training is that you basically just stand back, put your hands up in the air and say, how can I help you? Because you just really don't want to have a confrontation. No. But having said that, Alan, my experience is, there's a cross-section of people out there in the community, and some people, you know, if it's your own store and it's your own stock and you're paying for it at the end of the day, then the inclination is to be a bit more a bit more aggressive. One of the things I would say to people is if it makes sense and if it's possible to do it without putting yourself in danger, it's always handy to try and grab a vehicle or a registration, because that can actually assist police in identifying people as well. So, mind you, there are a hell of a lot of false registration plates out there as well. But that would be, I within reason and being super careful, that is something that can sort of assist to pass on. And obviously, if you're lucky enough to be able to grab a photo, that would be even better. But again, don't put yourself in danger. And again, training. So staff training and basically have them, you know, it's obviously, and we read in the paper how extremely confronting it is when people get, you know, people get confronted and robbed.
Peter, I've got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more. I'm talking to Peter from Absolute Facts. Peter, we're not accusing anybody, but I'm only here to ask the questions, and the question was asked of me. If you own a business, whether it be retail or a factory, again, if you were setting it up to protect yourself against fraud, now we're talking about mainly here where a worker decides that they need to stock more than you do, whether that be in a retail environment or a manufacturing environment, how would you, if I was setting the business up and I came to you and said, Peter, how am I going to protect myself? What sort of things would you do, and what sort of way would you keep an eye on what was going on?
So I'll start with the factory one first then. So industrial factory type setup. I think what happens a lot of times with them is they can grow very quickly, or it could be a family business that, you know, perhaps wins a big contract or just keeps expanding. And there's an expectation maybe with the workers who could well be family to perhaps help themselves to as much as they want of the product or things like stationery and things like that. Yep. Unfortunately, then when you get too big and you start expanding and that expectation stays, then it's very difficult to nip that in the bud. So perhaps it's not such a good idea to have that as a course of conduct in the first instance. Yep. Even though that's probably easier to say than actually enforce. And then obviously from again, stock taking is important, placement of goods, access to the car park perhaps from within the factory. So do people have the ability to walk out in the middle of the shift and fill their boot up with your product, etc.? So that would be the sort of factory industrial side of it.
Yep.
From a retail sense, I've written down things like general awareness, I beg your pardon, and vigilance. Looking for something unusual, a particularly nervous or maybe very young person, or a customer making a substantive purchase or something like that, that sort of, if with your experience with what you're doing and your particular presumably niche sort of market, you probably would sense if something doesn't quite look right or doesn't add up. One of the aspects here, of course, particularly in the retail environment, Alan, is looking and checking for counterfeit notes, the 50s and the 100s. So the guidelines there is the paper should not be too thick, nor for that matter too thin. If you're concerned, perhaps grab another note that you know is a genuine note and put them side by side and see if there's any obvious flaws or comparison. And again, as I say, the paper can sometimes be a bit of a giveaway. And as I think the Reserve Bank puts this up, there's a simple scrunch test with the modern notes, because they're basically plastic. If you scrunch the note up and it doesn't spring back into shape, then the odds are that it's probably a counterfeit note.
All right. I didn't know that.
Yep. So again, probably more in the retail sense, look for unusual methods of payment. So that could even be probably more so online. Nervousness in respect to the customer or purchases that don't match the shopper. Now, again, that probably goes back to the person's own experience with who their customers are and their customer profile, what they tend to buy. And if you've got someone coming to the store that sort of doesn't look the part, or could even be the wrong gender or something, and they're buying things that just don't seem right, then that would probably make me a little bit wary. And of course, one of the biggest factors, as you've kind of touched on already, is staff and monitoring staff and even employing staff in the first instance. And I think I brought up an example not too long ago where I had a solicitor client of mine, pay a couple of $100 for a basic probity check on someone who was applying for a position of responsibility, handling money and all that sort of thing, and turned out that person was never going to be employed after, you know, doing a little bit of homework.
$200 well spent, wasn't it?
Yeah, $220 with the GST. It was very well spent. And of course, police checks. A lot of jobs now require police checks. Working with children checks, all that kind of thing. Keep all those things up to date. You know, run them again every, I think this is something that people probably don't do in business, is run the police checks perhaps every 3 years or 5 years or even 1 year if you're in a particularly sensitive environment, so that you're confident that people haven't gone astray whilst they've been employed with you.
Good point. Yep.
So, and again, look, sometimes just basic things. I jotted this down because it's something I've come across before. Wearing inappropriate clothes for the weather. So, in other words, it's 40 degrees and you've got someone walking around with a big, thick, long jacket on. So, I think that's probably, chances are they're up to no good.
Oh, yeah.
Spending too long in your store. Again, your own personal knowledge of what you're selling and people coming and going. If someone's spending an unusual or inordinate amount of time in the store, be a little bit wary of that. Obviously, you know, looking around repeatedly. And the other one, of course, is that often a second person will be employed as a distraction. So if you've got a sense of that, you know, two people walk in, or sometimes I walk in 30 seconds apart or less, I guess, and then one person's up at the counter asking sort of inane or odd questions that, you know, really don't seem to make sense, then the chances are the second person's the one that's pocketing items, etc.
Terrible.
And of course, the other one that comes up from time to time too is that sometimes it can be, in inverted commas, Alan, your best customer, your most friendly person that comes in every day and has a bit of a chat and sort of disarms you, if you like. That can be a bit of a pointer as well. They might actually be a very good crook that relies on the fact that you know them, or you think you know them, and you're kind of probably less guarded or less wary of what they're up to, and they could be the one that's ripping you off more than what you think. So
well, I've just got to take a quick break.
Sure.
And I'll come back to you, and because then we've got a question for you to go away and have a look at too, plus. That was Dolly Parton, I Will Always Love You. And coming up just before the news, we'll be listening to Pink Floyd with Lucifer Sam, because Peter loves Pink Floyd, so he knows all about them, but we've put that in for Peter. Peter, there's a couple of questions, and I think we've, because we've delayed them a bit, I'm not sure we've ever had an answer on them. First of all, one was the court cases that you've been involved in, where you've actually had to take a case to court. I know your job is absolute facts, is to get the facts, but we've had a couple of inquiries over a period of time, and I think that one's fallen off our thing. Was it any court case? We don't want to know the actual outcome. Well, I guess we want to know the outcome, but just in brief details. And we had a question the other day which brought up the reminder that we hadn't covered that court cases. Somebody would like to know the longest case you've ever been involved in.
Right.
Either getting the facts or getting it to court or whatever it was. Just how long the longest one has taken from the time someone walked into your office and said, Peter, I need you to do something about this.
Sure. Okay. Yep. I had that down as homework, but I haven't. I'm having a bit of a think about that one still. But I will. Yep. I will come up with that. To be honest with you, though, Alan, I don't get called as a witness these days because, again, as I say, the quality of the evidence, albeit CCTV or logs and still photographs, is you don't often get challenged. They pretty much have to accept that. Your submission and your affidavit is, they're not going to challenge it.
I guess, particularly with those, we're talking about the cases, it doesn't matter how long ago, they might have been 5 years ago, just to get a bit of an idea as to how long you have to work on a case. I mean, some are probably pretty quick, some are pretty long, and if you've had to go to court, and if not, and just the longest case you've worked on, whether it was over 3 months, 6 months, or whatever. Peter, I'm conscious of the time. I think you still had some homework that you've been working on, haven't you?
No, I haven't. I think I've done my homework. I was just going to finish off the in respect to the protecting against fraud. Obviously, online is your biggest risk at the moment. So be careful of scams as best as you can. Things like unusual payment methods. People asking for couriers to be sent out to pick up the items, things like that, fake bank transfers, for argument's sake. You've got to be careful with that and make sure the funds have actually hit.
We were talking to somebody in here the other week on an interview, and part of it they told me that somebody lost $600,000. It came out on the legitimate, they'd sold the house. The money was in the trust account at the solicitors. They got a letter from or an email from the solicitor, pay it over, we're ready to settle. They didn't check it, and the whole $600,000 just went kaput.
Yeah, and I think obviously the banks are have got a role to play in that as well. So hopefully that those people got their money back as they could.
It was gone.
They didn't, yeah, and I think that's the part where if you're not a fan of the banks, that's probably another good reason why you're not a fan of the of the banks. Speaking of which, just briefly, Alan, I see there's some legislation. I think it's in the proposal stage, which includes a clause saying that you are not allowed to say anything derogative against the Australian banks because it may affect the stability of the financial markets and their good standing, which will be very interesting to see how that comes into effect. And
I can see where you're taking that.
Oh yes, and that would be a very interesting first test case, I would have thought, when some poor bunny puts their foot in their mouth. But never mind. Hopefully, that's not. Not going to be either of us.
Well, it's not going to be me, I can tell you.
No, that's right. So a couple of articles have come across over the last little while, Alan. This one, and we've just touched on setting up a business, but unfortunately there's information that suggests, it's creditor watch data, just to credit the people that have put this up, is Australian businesses, private Australian businesses, are basically failing, including primarily defaulting on tax debts. I've got here 7,003 have become insolvent or voluntary closed after defaulting on tax debts exceeding 100,000 each and overdue by more than 90 days. So presumably the tax office has taken action or along those lines. So information, media, telecommunications sector has experienced the highest failure rate due to tax debts at 55%, followed by electricity, gas, water and waste services at 47%. So that's you're talking about setting up businesses. Well, unfortunately, I think it's going the other way at the moment. And another thing that we kind of touched on a little bit, but it's and about legislation and things like that. And, of course, everyone's talking about AI at the moment. And again, Australians, the article reads, Australians will be protected from high-risk uses of artificial intelligence, such as hiring and firing, facial recognition in public, or disinformation under sweeping new safety measures. So this is where, again, legislation perhaps falls behind the actual technology. But when you read it that way, it sounds as if they're going to have a massive crackdown on things like that about facial recognition in public. Drew my attention, obviously.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I haven't seen it. I don't know how that's going to work, but that one pricked my curiosity.
Nice.
And then, of course, we've just spoken about scams, and there's an article that basically refers to a scandemic, a new plague of dodgy schemes, all sorts of things ranging from fake Taylor Swift concert tickets and to the transfers from banks, as you've just mentioned, and changing payment systems and payment arrangements. So I guess if you made regular payments to a particular person, and then all of a sudden you got an email saying we've got a new account, I think the advice would be to ring the actual company yourself and say, have you actually genuinely changed your bank details?
Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you. You've almost got to do that with any amount of money that before you hand it over, don't you?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. And again, on the fact of being a bit frugal and saving costs, apparently eloping is becoming more popular, Alan. So,
is it?
So it's obviously a lot cheaper to elope, I wouldn't suspect, and people can perhaps give you money towards something, you know, perhaps like a house deposit rather than spending it on the big flash wedding. So that pricked my curiosity as well. And then finally, unfortunately, a Finder survey has found that people are pretty much broke by payday. So unfortunately, 52% of people are occasionally or always borrowing money before the next paycheck comes in to stay afloat. So that's
where some of these money lenders are coming into it, aren't they, which you're trying to cut out a bit.
Yes. I think you need to look pretty closely at the actual cost of those of that borrowings. Yeah,
Peter. Unfortunately, I've just got about 30 seconds before I've got to go. We will pay Pink Floyd, Lucifer Sam, for you. Again, thank you for your time, Peter. It's always a great time to have you in, and we'll look forward to be November next time, won't it?
Yes, it will be November, and that's a very early Pink Floyd track, that one. It's actually off the debut album, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and was a Syd Barrett composition, talking about his cat.
Talking about his cat?
Yes.
Van Ingham. I didn't know that. Well, so it was all
a bit psychedelic back then, so who knows?
You're our expert. All right, Peter, thank you for your time, and I'll talk to you next month.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks,
cheers.
Mate.